Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
Hey, Gib.
We're going to start with an email. This is from Michelle, and it's in reference to an interview that we conducted on a study about swearing. When do people usually do it? They do it in the afternoon or evening. And there's possibly a biological mechanism somewhere in us that swearing kind of jolts us awake. That's why it happens late. That's the effect it has on us. She writes, "Good day. I'm an 80-year-old young bilingual French woman. I do use the F word too often, according to some. The interesting thing for me, though, if I swear in English, it doesn't give me the arousal that's supposed to happen." She means the energy or the kick.
Yeah.
But if I swear in French, she doesn't say that one. I'm going to read these. We'll probably have to bleep them out. I don't know what they mean. That gives me quite a bit of satisfaction. Swearing in English for me is not swearing. I wonder if a study has been made about swearing in your mother tongue or your native language. Love your show. Been listening to it since COVID started. My body is trained to wake up at 4:30 a.m. on Sunday just in time to listen to your program. All the best, Michelle. And thank you, Michelle. Yeah.
My email is addressed to you. Hi, Connor. I didn't write in, but every time I had a craving for chips this week, I grabbed a handful of nuts.
Yes.
And was grateful.
Yes. Somebody. I mentioned last week that nobody reacted to a suggestion that I'd provided as a way to eat healthier in connection to cardiovascular health, kind of, ultimately. But the tip was, instead of chips, or in British English, crisps, go for nuts. And nobody had said anything. Now we have somebody who is doing that.
Somebody is Christina. She goes on. "Also, my sleep is terrible, and I think I swear more than I probably should. But I can also say that I enjoy swearing. So as long as I'm saying it in a fun way, not an aggressive way, I particularly like swearing in situations where it's not entirely expected from someone like me. I like getting some raised eyebrows, irreverence as comedy." And then she provides a nice little list here of her favorite swear words. "Just filthy. Somewhere my mother is gripping a bar of soap."
Oh, as always, to wash her mouth out.
Yeah, well, my grandma did that to me.
I had that done to me.
And she whipped me with a pitching wedge, but, well, that's a different show. "As always, thanks for the show, Christina."
Christina, thank you for your email. And to all of you out there who've been writing us. And if we have time later, I'll get to one last email. But first, an important subject, very serious subject. And I'm just going to sort of introduce it by playing a clip from a person who is suffering from, and I'm going to quote here, the most misunderstood serious illness. And we're going to hear from a younger woman whose name we have changed to Larissa.
Ich liege halt im Bett, im Dunkeln mit Zugezug und Vorhängen.
Do you mean, what are my days like? Well, I'm lying down in bed in the dark with the covers on and curtains shut. Whenever I do anything, it could be moving around or something like sending a voice message, I need a break after. I always call it a rest period, where I just lie still with an eye mask on and earplugs in. When I do get up in the morning, I usually feel pretty sick at first, like a mixture of a concussion and burning nerves.
Es ist halt immer so, zur Toilette gehen, ausruhen, essen, ausruhen, Zähne putzen, ausruhen.
It's always like, go to the bathroom, rest, eat, rest, brush your teeth, rest. I can decide, like today, for example, to skip brushing my teeth. Then I have the capacity to send voice messages and things like that.
Zähneputzen weglasse und dafür habe ich dann Kapazitäten, Sprachnachricht zu schicken oder sowas.
Kind of a longer clip there, but I wanted to give all of you a feel for what this disease feels like. We're talking about what most people refer to as chronic fatigue syndrome, ME CFS, the ME standing for myalgic, meaning pain or tenderness in your muscles. Encephalomyelitis, that's basically saying that your brain or spine are inflamed. 17 million people around the world suffer from that disease, mostly women. Women tend to have chronic fatigue syndrome more often than men do. And it is a severe disability, as you clearly can understand there from Larissa. She's sending a WhatsApp message from her darkened bedroom.
We have met one of those 17 million people. If you obviously remember this. This was a few years back. We were doing a report about blood washing for COVID at a clinic in Mülheim an der Ruhr. And we met a young woman there who was having her blood washed, not for long COVID, but because she has CFS or ME?
CFS.
Yeah. CFS.
In connection with it. Yeah, they're apheresis. It's a kind of, it's a therapy that some of you might be familiar with in connection with high cholesterol.
Cholesterol, exactly.
High cholesterol that's resistant to medication for high cholesterol. And it's a way of kind of, you can imagine it as thinning out your blood, making it circulate better. And that connects back to what doctors and researchers think is a part of the problem, a very complex, multifaceted problem. That's why there's no solution at this point.
The only reason I brought her up, that woman, she was very angry. Very angry at the world, possibly in connection with what you mentioned, misunderstood. That the world does not know how bad it is to have this disease.
It ends your life. Effectively, you're immobile, and not only that, for so many years, for decades, a lot of people thought it was a mental problem. Hey, get over it. Come on, get up and get out of bed. I mean, it's the worst of all worlds. Larissa herself, at one point, and I should thank my colleague Anna Carthouse, who's been in contact with her and who will soon be publishing an article on this topic,
and Kathleen Schuster for voicing the English version of the clip.
Yeah, and Kathleen Schuster, thank you. She effectively said we're like garbage, except kind of, at least with garbage, you know where to put it. Where do you put us? What do you do with us? So you feel terrible. Society looks at you critically. Hopefully not. Hopefully the people listening,
because they don't even believe that you have this affliction. You're making it up. Or
nobody knows what it is. Yeah. And again, just to get back into a little of the science, the best we know, what we do know at this point, is that it usually happens the very first time after a severe infection that kicks it off, which is a clear sign that this is probably connected to some sort of autoimmune disorder.
Meaning that in order to try and fight off that virus, your body attacks your own cells, or
correct,
not
correct.
The virus itself, but your own cells somewhere.
Correct. B cells specifically, your body is creating antibodies that are attacking healthy cells. Mm-hmm. Not just the infected ones, but healthy cells, nerve cells as well. That's why people are their bodies are in a constant state of inflammation and energy-less POTS. This is the connected to your heart, where if you sit up or stand up, your heart starts racing. Measurably high levels of stress, even though there is no stress. Exhaustion all the time. Also this post-exertional malaise. So if you go out and do something, then you're sidelined for days sometimes.
Like Larissa was saying there, sending a text message and then having to take a break after that. Going to the bathroom and then taking a break.
A text message.
Yeah.
Her life is functionally ended, which is why any sign of hope, any sign of a therapy in the future is great news. There are three that I'm going to mention here. One of them is in connection with the Charité Hospital in Berlin. That was where that first quote came from, the most misunderstood illness. And Carmen Scheibenbogen is her name. She and her team there work only on this, specifically on this, I should say. And she has tried one therapy that just flushes the antibodies out. And that seems to cause rapid recovery in some patients, but this is not yet a therapy. There haven't been clinical trials, and it might not work for everyone. But for some people, that has seemed to help. You're talking about the blood washing in Mülheim. The last we got an update from them or spoke with them, it was inconclusive whether that was going to work, because again, there you're treating—
With regard to long COVID— But also to ME-CFS.
Yes, okay. Because there you're talking about, you're treating the symptoms, but not the cause. And finally, that gets to the cause. What is it? There are pending clinical trials that would target the B cells that produce those antibodies that attack the healthy cells. That's always very dangerous, because what if you accidentally get rid of good immune cells that are attacking the right things? Very, very complex, but there are hopefully therapies around the corner. Until then, I think for a lot of people, it's about hanging on and holding on to hope. I'm going to play one last clip from Larissa to, I guess, give you her vision of her future.
Also ich persönlich, ich bin weit davon entfernt, an Sterbehilfe zu denken.
Personally, I'm nowhere even close to considering assisted suicide. But I do have to say that this illness has changed my view of death and dying. I mean, it is a little bit reassuring to know that it won't go on like this forever. Dying is a little bit of a reassuring prospect in this situation. But as for me, I'd also like to say that if I ever do get to the point where I want to seek assisted suicide, then it definitely won't be because I want to die, but out of love for life, because I want to live. Because with my entire being, I long so much to live. I just can't do that with this illness.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's obviously a very hard thing to listen to. I sort of questioned whether or not we should even air that, broadcast that, because, talking in any way about suicide is always a point where we should remind our listeners around the world. There are hotlines if you've ever had these kinds of thoughts. Here, it's just to demonstrate how severe this illness is for Larissa specifically, but also for many of the 17 million people around the world who have it. The International Day of Awareness is May 12th. That is a Monday. And one simple thing you can do is you wear blue, a blue, bright blue t-shirt or pants or whatever you have that's blue that shows sort of solidarity with people. But I think you've already done enough, honestly, as well, by listening and trying to understand this.
DW. Made for minds.
Before we go, cocktail party effect. You know that that was a thing?
The cocktail party effect? Yeah. Meaning something happens at a cocktail party and then what happens?
No, the inability to hear in situations where there's background noise.
Oh, yeah. 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 Kind of an excuse sometimes to lean a little closer to you, right? Uh-huh. People use it that way for sure.
There was a study done at the University of Buffalo, New York, into hearing in noise. And they were looking at 40 people aged between 20 and 80, and they had them do a hearing test. So they figured out first who has problems hearing when there's a lot of background noise. And then they gave all 40 of those people an fMRI to check at base level what's going on in their brains. And they found for the people who can't hear well when there's background noise, a particular part of their brain was activated when there was no background noise, the insula. And that's a part, there are two of them, they're insulae, and they are connected with the frontal lobes, which means that that's the part of the brain when you're trying to make sense of information, incoming information, perception, noise, that's at work. And it's also connected with dementia. So what they have found here possibly in this experiment is that when you have trouble hearing in noise, your brain gets rewired in order to help you hear when that noise is going on, to make sense of that information coming in, and that this could be a way to better understand how dementia happens, because this area of the brain is associated with dementia, and when your brain needs help or isn't working right normally, it rewires itself.
Borrows resources.
Causes a possible overload, a cognitive overload, which could lead to decline. That's what they're looking at. I just wanted to mention that because it seems like they're onto something there.
I was going to say, a lot of research within the last 5 years or so on the connection between hearing loss and neurodegenerative diseases. I feel like previously people weren't really talking about that. And that's an interesting...
They are now.
And that's an interesting take on it, because I had just thought the lack of auditory information means your brain, especially the social parts, they're dialing down. You're not as engaged. You're losing the social aspect of being a human being. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's connected with cognitive loss. We mentioned an 80-year young woman, one of our listeners, Michelle. I know we have a lot of listeners somewhere in that age group, and that's when hearing loss tends to really kick in. So I guess I'm asking you mostly, what's your take on this? Have you noticed, I don't know, anything about the way you experience or perceive the world through your ears as that dials down? What happens? What are the consequences of that? That's I think a bigger deal than most people realize. We tend to focus on eyeglasses and not the hearing aids as much in terms of what we pay attention to.
For the rest of the show, we are going to focus on our ears, or what we do with our ears, namely music and older people.
That's true. Yeah, and to kind of set up for that interview, you're about to hear some music that Gabe and I began playing downstairs. We were actually recording a video for YouTube and TikTok with one of our colleagues, and then we just recorded all the music, and this is one part of it.
Are you old?
Yes.
No, I'm speaking to the people listening to this right now. Are you at least 65 years old?
No. Not you,
the people listening. If you are, and you don't know how to play a musical instrument, then this one is for you. We're going to be speaking to someone, a German researcher at the music school in Hanover, who has been working with the elderly, teaching people who have no idea how to play a musical instrument, how to play a musical instrument, and there's some really interesting results.
Science Unscripted.
So, yeah, hi, my name is Florian Worschech. I'm a researcher in Hanover, Germany, and in the field of music and the brain. And we and my colleagues and I recently published a study on music and the older people learning an instrument.
And what was the primary conclusion from that work, Florian?
Yeah, the primary conclusion is probably that it's never too late to learn new motor skills, and that, for example, learning to play an instrument elicits a lot of beneficial effects for healthy aging.
Okay, so you've got people who are as young as 65, and what was the upper limit?
The upper limit was 78.
So they're 65 to 78 years old. They have 1 hour of piano lessons per week, and then they've got homework. How much homework were they doing on the side?
Around 20 minutes a day.
Okay. So total of roughly, let's call it 3 hours per week of piano practice over the course of a year. They have the time to do this because they're retired. How good did they get? How good can our listeners out there hope to get if they start doing this at that age?
They learned how to read scores. They learned different rhythms. They learned, they could play small pieces. That was possible, but it was actually quite interesting how heterogeneous that was. I mean, some people picked it up really easily. Some others had trouble finding the right finger even after 12 months.
What was the difference between them? Do you have anything in your data to suggest or to imply what might be causing some people to learn better than others?
Yeah, that is actually what we looked at. So we looked at also musical skills and musical abilities, of course. So it's like the near transfer effects, let's say. And it was really hard to predict the learning success of musical skills or musical abilities. So this data suggests that there is a high genetic influence of musicality, let's say.
Let's put the ability to learn a musical instrument aside for a second. Connor and I are going to listen to the performance of one of the participants later. Let's focus now on what this does for these people. What did you find out during this 12-month period? What learning an instrument does for the brains of older people?
Yeah, we had three major outcomes. The first one was that the hearing improved. So the people improved in hearing speech and noise. The second was that the quality of life improved in the piano group. And the third one was that all behavioral outcomes were associated with certain brain changes.
And I'm assuming positive brain changes, not negative?
Well, let's say, yeah, it's always positive if the behavioral outcome is positive. But sometimes we also saw that some areas thinned instead of thickened.
When you say that the participants said that their quality of life improved, what exactly do you mean by that? What did playing a musical instrument do for their quality of life?
Yeah, so this questionnaire had four domains: the psychological, the physical, the social, and the environmental quality of life. And we could, for example, show that the psychological quality of life improved. And those are questions like, do you think your life has a meaning, for instance? And here we could see quite an improvement. And also at the physical quality of life, can you do what you want to do, or are you limited by your physical abilities, for instance?
How significant is this? Is it significant enough that everyone, as soon as they retire, like should start playing a piano if they can afford to, if they have a piano, if they can afford the lessons? Piano lessons are expensive. Or is it just like a moderate benefit? How important is this for people out there who are, enjoying their post-work life?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think it's very significant, but I always stress out that it is not really only the piano. I mean, it's important that you learn something new, that it is that you do something which you find enjoyable, and that things you get can be motivated from. And so it's not only the piano. If you play chess, so be it.
Florian, for all of the people out there listening to this right now who are probably skeptical of what you're saying, or the idea that they themselves could make these improvements in their lives and would enjoy the quality of life that you describe, talk to them. Can you tell them why they should do this directly?
Yeah, I think like music opened, like what our participant told us, is that music opened up a different world. I mean, you dive into something really new, and it is not only enjoyable to play it, but to understand music, go to concerts, see something new, let your like emotional systems get involved in music, and be curious. I think music has a lot to offer.
That was Florian Vorschech speaking to us from Hanover, and let us listen to one of the participants. This is 12 months of learning the piano. This is what he or she, don't know who they were, could play.
That is such a beautiful piece when it's played that way. Ode to Joy.
Almost better.
Yeah, that really it is.
Yeah.
It's like, give me either that or the full symphony that gives you goosebumps, but both are amazing.
You took piano as a kid. You were not as a 65-year-old. You took it as a what? As a
6.5. No, I probably eight or nine, and I hated it. I despised it.
It didn't make your quality of life better at that point.
The problem for me back then was, as a kid growing up in the United States, was who Beethoven, who and Mozart, who and why should I care? The reward for learning the piece, one of the pieces that I still hate, Für Elise,
yeah,
by Beethoven. I hate that piece because I had to practice it so much. And my reward from the piano teacher after performing it in front of parents was a bust of the man himself, Ludwig. I wanted to chuck it in the trash. Why do I? And then this bust was on top of the piano staring at me. And then I learned, a piece by Mozart, had Mozart. What I didn't have was a connection to modern music or the alternative music I was listening to. Now I love playing the piano and playing chords from songs I know and love and then kind of singing to them and doing that thing. But the rote memorization of or learning notes on paper, that wasn't for me at that time. Now I can appreciate it, but back then, no.
Following the interview with Florian, this is an appeal to whoever is listening to this right now all around the world. Will you, if you are over the age of 65, or actually it doesn't matter how old you are, would you consider learning a musical instrument? If you are musically naive, if you don't know how to sing or how to play any instrument, would you do it?
And one important thing to add, because we were just chatting with Florian afterwards, and the people learning the instrument weren't alone. There were two of them with the instructor. And I think that's worth noting just for the sake of the study, to understand the study, but also that's better in kind of every way. If you're paying for an instructor, you pay probably half price. You also learn from the mistakes that your peer helps you with and the other way around. I think all around, and maybe it works with like two or three people. Who knows? Yeah. That's a fun way to do it.
That would be the ideal way, learn in a group. But if you don't have that opportunity and you want to do this, tell us, send us recordings. We will chart this path with you and play whatever you want us to play along the way. That would be great. I would love that.
We'll put that music on the show. Just like that Ode to Joy right there, your music can land on the show if you put the work in. That's I guess, our promise to you right now. I'm saying it.
And get it started by writing to us at su@dw.com.